Hey, it's Andrew here, and welcome to the Ecom Fuel Podcast, the show dedicated to helping 7- and 8-figure brands build incredible businesses and amazing lives. And it is 2 days before we kick off ECF Live here in Bozeman, Montana. Are you starting to see the, of course, when this airs, it will be all wrapped up and in the bag, but starting to see the text come in, the app start to come alive, people posting pictures, and it's exciting. A few things left to get done, so it's kind of scrambling there. We got 24 hours left, but very much excited. So for everyone listening to this after the fact, thank you for coming. And in the past, I'm looking forward to a really great week. So all that said, I don't have a new episode this Friday. We are going to go back into the archives for one of my favorite discussions of the past year, talking with David Heacock of filterby.com. David was a member for years and in the community, and just has done something pretty amazing. If you missed it last time, built this business into a $250 million powerhouse, manufacturing these filters all in the United States. It's a really cool story, and he's a sharp guy. So hope you enjoy this one, especially if you missed it last time. And we'll be back a week from today with a recap of ECF Live, how everything went, our biggest takeaways. Just give you a little, little taste of the event if you didn't happen to make it. Or if you did, you can see how right we get it and see, maybe catch a few stories that you missed. So thanks so much. Catch you in a week and hope you enjoy this one with David. Hey, it's Andrew here, and welcome to the Ecom Fuel Podcast, the show dedicated to helping 7- and 8-figure brand owners build incredible businesses and amazing lives. And today is kicking off a 2-episode series on manufacturing in America. We've got two brands, one today's brand that ended up making it work very well, and another brand that we talked to who, despite their best efforts to make things here in the U.S., it just didn't make sense. It wasn't financially viable. And in today's episode, joined by David Heacock, who is the CEO of filterby.com. I had the chance to get to know David early in my career. I think, and as we talk about, he gave a presentation at our second ever ECF Live, I think back in like 2015. Sharp guy, and he has grown the business to $250 million per sale, or $250 million per year in sales, making everything domestically here in the United States. Fascinating discussion. So we talk about how he's been able to do that. He's got over 1,000 people. They manufacture a lot of this stuff. Matter of fact, manufacture all of this stuff with a large team. So how are they able to do this from a cost perspective, competing with overseas labor? It's a really interesting answer that he gives. We talk about what it was like setting up the factory. We talk about how Amazon has played a role. We talk about what areas are and are not feasible to manufacture in the United States. It's a really enjoyable conversation. David has one of the things I appreciate about him is he has a long-term perspective on a lot of things, which you will see throughout this episode. And I think some of his insights will be pretty helpful as we're kind of thinking through what the next 5-10 years holds. So I hope you enjoy this one with David. Let's get into it. Well, David, welcome to the show. And I want to thank you. I mentioned it kind of when we were talking a minute ago, but that second ECF Live we ever did in Nashville, where we were still very much trying to figure out what we were doing, you gave one of the best talks of the year. I remember it really well. And even just talking now, you were talking about how back then you were playing with FBA, but really thinking about how even back in 2015, some of the advantages there were not sustainable. Anyway, it might be an interesting way to kick this off. And we're going to dive into your story here in just a second here, but that'd be kind of fun if you could maybe go through back then what was going through your mind either then or shortly thereafter in terms of competitive advantage on online and with Amazon.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think I started FilterBuy in 2012, at the end of 2012. I was looking for a product that we could manufacture competitively in the US and sell direct to end user. And I kind of whittled it down between remanufactured ink cartridges and pleated air filters were the two markets that I had determined were interesting because they have a lot of variation. And logistically, I did not think there would be you can't compete with overseas exports because they're logistically challenged for different reasons in each of the two markets. So those are the two kind of product lines that I decided between and ultimately settled on pleated air filters as our kind of product offering and started the process of manufacturing air filters. But within a couple of years, you know, it was a really kind of rough start. We can maybe talk about that a bit later. But I remember joining your forum in the e-commerce Fuel and saw a lot of people that were starting to have a lot of success, you know, importing products from overseas and doing this whole business model. And I started exploring it myself and using it to expand our product lines into humidifier filters and air purifier filters and whatnot that were, you know, predominantly made in China, and started importing containers of them. And I did that for about a year or so, and remember coming to speak at your conference and doing a whole spreadsheet on long tail FBA and how, you know, there were a rise of all these kind of products that you could, you know, buy overseas and, you know, there were long tail and get a lot of traction selling. And But I remember very distinctly that was kind of like the peak of my long tail FBA business, so to speak, because very quickly after, I had two events. One, I started seeing some of our other listings that had weird kind of brand names pop up. And I realized that ultimately our manufacturer was starting to compete with us on Amazon directly. I started that and I thought, this is not going to be a good ending. And then in January of 2016, I actually had a big warehouse fire where I had just moved like all of our imported goods to like a different warehouse from our manufacturing facility. It was about 2 months into it, and I woke up to a call at 3 o'clock in the morning that the place had burned down because we actually put in like a new microwave in the break room, and it was faulty. And the insurance company decided at the end it was faulty, and it lit the whole place on fire, and all of my imported goods, you know, burned to the ground. And that was what kind of when I made the decision that I was going to get completely out of the imported goods business and go all in on manufacturing my own products, which was our core kind of offering anyways. And I just kind of doubled down on that and really have not looked back since.
We're going to get into the economics and how you reverse engineered kind of a great product and all that in a minute here. And I'm usually not someone who likes to dive into people's backstories in a whole lot of depth. I think it's much more interesting to kind of hear what's happening now and kind of more recent takes on business and what they're thinking about. But your story is different in the fact that I think it's very integral to the arc of FilterBuy, and also just especially given kind of where we are with the climate of manufacturing in America and tariffs. I think it makes a lot of sense to dive into. Plus, selfishly, I'm just curious, so I'm going to do it. But you grew up, so this the business you own, FilterBuy. You transitioned to filters in 2012, but you grew up working in this business, which is a family manufacturing business. But it was doing something else back in the day, right?
Kind of. So I grew up in Talladega, Alabama, and you know, Alabama was really driven by textiles in the, you know, 70s to the 90s. Like the textile industry was the big industry. And my grandfather, when he came back from World War II, actually started a company that was selling parts to the textile industry called Talladega Machinery and Supply Company. Started in 1952. And so I grew up, you know, kind of seeing that family business and then ultimately seeing it get decimated in NAFTA in the early 90s when all the textiles basically got shipped out. And they pivoted into the wood products industry where they started selling supplies to sawmills and whatnot in the Southeast. And, you know, I ultimately went to college and I wanted to get as far away from Alabama as I possibly could and, you know, took a job at Goldman Sachs in New York where I was an options trader. And I did that for the first 7 years of my career. And anyways, in 2012, my family was going through the sale of what was left of this family business called Talladega Machinery and Supply Company, which is basically a supplier for like a wholesaler for the wood products industry. They would buy, you know, like the chemical that treats wood for molding and resell it to sawmills in the Southeast. And so, you know, we had about three or four outside salespeople and their average age was in the 60s. And we were buying and selling products with very low margin. My family was just going to kind of sell it for what it was worth to get out of it. And my grandfather was still alive and it is in his early 90s and I was close with him and he did not want to see it sold. And so I ultimately decided to quit my job and buy Talladega Machinery and Supply Company, which was a dying, you know, industrial supply house, more or less. So I bought that in September 30th, 2012. And I had to decide what I was going to do with it. And that's when I kind of started brainstorming about like, what could I do with this kind of infrastructure, the space, people and whatnot that I had, which was not much. And that is what ultimately led me to finding the air filter market. But that's the very long story short.
You know, you were in New York at the time working for Goldman, right?
Correct.
So you're in New York. What goes into a decision like that? You're in a job and a career where you've worked, you've got some, you know, it's 7 years, you got a little bit of institutional reputation, you've got some stability, you're making good money in New York City. A lot of people, you know, love to live there. Why, from the outside looking in, to many people, that seems like a very perplexing move to leave that world, go back to your roots, and not just, you know, buy a family business, but buy a family business that is really on the last leg, struggling. What's going on in your brain?
You know, I don't know that I have the guts to repeat it today, but I tell you, you know, I was 29 years old and I'd always been entrepreneurial. Like I was, you know, born entrepreneurial, and I lived through the financial crisis. And in 2008, 2009, I was convinced I was going to lose my job. You know, I was 2 or 3 years in, fairly junior, and saw all the pain with that. But I was pretty convinced I was going to lose my job. And that's when I actually started side hustles. I was a big affiliate marketer, and I was actually one of the largest affiliates for StubHub in 2008. Actually made more money from that than I did from my day job. And in 2009, I was like, well, it'd be great to own an offer or whatever. And I started a company called My Office Delivered, where we were effectively drop shipping office supplies. And in 2009, I actually scaled that to about $5.5 million of revenue, mostly sold on Amazon. And over half of that business was either remanufactured ink cartridges or air filters, but we were drop shipping at very low margin. And I ended up not losing my job, and my career really took off, and I got promoted, and I ultimately had to shut down that business because I couldn't do that side hustle anymore. Well, I did it for a few more years, and kind of two things happened. My family was going through the sale of the family business, and that kind of brought back some feelings around that. And I kind of looked around and I was thinking, you know, what is this world going to look like, or what is the finance world going to look like 10 or 20 years from now when I'm 40 or 50 years old? And, you know, I was effectively a bookie for hedge funds. I mean, like that is how I would describe my job. Is like, if a hedge fund wanted to get some action, then I was one they call, I make a market for them and give them that action. But like that was effectively my job description. And, you know, I honestly did not believe that job would continue to exist 10 or 20 years from now, because I thought, well, what value am I actually offering to society? Like, I could not articulate what my actual value was, why I should exist. And I also thought that it was going to all be automated, because, you know, I thought so much of what I was doing, ultimately, technology was going to be able to do. So I did not like my forward curve or my perceived forward curve of what my career path was going to look like. And I knew that at 29, it was before I had children, that if I wanted to do something risky, that was kind of my last chance. Otherwise, I'm stuck on this train. And having lived through the financial crisis, kind of not being able to understand why, you know, my job existed, like why, you know, why I was getting paid or whatever, a disproportionate amount of money, a ridiculous amount of money, not being able to articulate that to myself and not feeling good about it was really the push. And because I was so entrepreneurial and always had been, and had already always experimented and had side hustles and all that kind of stuff, I had the confidence to kind of take the leap and go all in on doing it. But it's why, like, in my content or when I tell, like, I talk with a lot of young people now, and I really do encourage that early experimentation, you know, especially like while you have other income streams or other jobs or whatever, because that is ultimately what leads you down the rabbit holes that give you the insights and the confidence you need to actually do something on your own. And so it was really an evolution of things that gave me both the confidence and the insight to do what I am doing today.
Essentially, my sister's in the finance industry, and she just this last week got a tour of the New York Stock Exchange on the floor. And so this is a little secondhand, so take it with a grain of salt. And David, you understand better than I do how this all works. But The one thing that stood out to her was she was shocked at how few people were on the floor, right? And how kind of calm and quiet it was. And they even went up and talked to one trader or market maker. They didn't want to bother him. He said, oh, don't worry. I can step away. I can talk for five. It's not a big deal. Just the algorithm will keep kind of running things for me, which is interesting. Kind of ties what you're saying a little bit. Kind of you were prescient. And you seem like you've had a really good long-term approach to spotting vulnerabilities and weaknesses that are going to get kind of arbitraged or, you know, due to tech or whatever, moved away. So you're at this point, you buy the business and you got to figure out what to sell and what to do. Talk a little bit. You talked at the top about ink cartridges and air filters. Talk a little bit about how you narrowed down the options and why those two in particular you felt like held an advantage for domestic manufacturing that overseas competitors couldn't compete with.
Yeah. So how I found out about them was what I explained before. I was drop shipping lots of products and I just noticed through our data that there was a lot of demand for all different variations of both of these two things, because both of them have lots of variation in sizes and they're consumable products that people have to come back and buy over and over again, right? So because of my experimentation earlier, I already had insight into these kind of, you know, products that maybe would not be so obvious to someone from the outside. So that's where that experimentation came in. But then, you know, and by the way, I looked at other things that were not consumable that maybe sold a lot, or other things that, you know, I could not spot any type of competitive advantage. And ultimately, like caster wheels were one thing, or like a number, I looked at a lot of other things, but ultimately it was the things that stood out to me were the consumable and lots of variation, large demand. And so that kind of was how I narrowed it down to those two. The remanufactured ink cartridges, the way that market at least used to work, I'm not an expert on it anymore, is you would actually collect ink cartridges from companies or people that are, you know, in institutions that were actually using them. And then you would take them back and then you would put them through a production process to refill them and then resell them back to that company. That is basically how it works. And so by definition, you have to be somewhat local and you have to build kind of economies of scale within that to make it work. So that was one avenue that I was looking at, because I was like, if I could crack that code, then I would have a competitive advantage if I was able to execute against that. And you can't import them. There are a lot of IP issues and stuff with ink cartridges, which is why I ultimately got out of that or decided not to pursue it. But, you know, there were, at least at the time, there were a lot of people that were trying to do this and some people doing it pretty successfully. And I thought I could kind of carve a niche that was local, you know, meaning in the US, to be able to build that out. Air filters are different in that, you know, there are, you know, hundreds of sizes of air filters in practice, and really, you know, like an unlimited number of custom sizes that actually exist. So like lots of old buildings that have like weird air duct systems or old school systems, all this kind of stuff, they have these custom size air filters that, you know, you ultimately have to cut and cap kind of real time to be able to get it to size. Like it's not something you're buying off the shelf and standard. And so when I first got into it, I thought I was actually just going to do the customization work, which was kind of the niche I had spotted. I was going to buy the kind of standard filters from local manufacturers and do the custom work. So that was like the initial insight that I had. But I quickly realized that the air filter business has absolutely nothing to do with air filters. It's actually all about the logistics, because it's the cost of the filter is a very small percentage of the cost that an end user is actually paying for that filter. And, you know, like you look at it today, you know, we manufacture a filter on average for about $2. So it would be like our actual cost. But our average selling price blended across a lot of SKUs is around $12. So, you know, you say, oh, that's just a high margin, great business, right? But it's not so simple. The reason why we're able to do that is because of the logistics operation that we have that allows that. So like fast forward to today, we make 120,000 filters a day and we ship them in an average of 4.5 to a package to homes and businesses across the country. So it's really the logistics game, not the air filter game. Air filter just happens to be our product, if that makes sense. But I realized that early on, and that is what ultimately gives you like the advantage as a U.S. manufacturer versus even making in Mexico, which a lot of our like retail competitors make them in Mexico and then ship them via trucks to distribution centers that then get sent out to other distribution centers that then get repackaged and then sent to the end user, whereas we're manufacturing everything and shipping it direct to that end user, taking out all of that packaging, all of that movement cost, which is such a big portion of the price that an end user ultimately pays. So that was the insight that I had. And I knew that like a Chinese company would not be able to competitively compete with us because of that logistics advantage, for instance. You would have to have, you know, 1,000 containers on order at any given time, plus shoot like, you know, 50 million square feet of space in the US to be able to replicate what we do within a 2-week turn of our manufacturing process. So that's kind of order of magnitude of the difference.
Makes total sense. What, when you think about retooling your factories and your systems to go from, you know, selling old equipment to doing air filters, which you had not been doing, talk through a few of the maybe experiences, anecdotes, or lessons in that process. How hard was it to spin up a brand new manufacturing facility doing something you hadn't done before with machinery, with the processes, everything?
Incredibly difficult. And, you know, I say it took me about 3 years to get to the point where I could manufacture a filter cheaper than I could buy it from a local manufacturer. The only reason we were able to kind of keep it going was because of our, you know, direct to consumer business, because we were actually getting a higher price point, at least. Like if we were trying to sell, you know, wholesale or, you know, competing with other manufacturers at that time, we would have gone bust. But the thing that I underestimated is the institutional knowledge that it takes in order to spin up a, you know, manufacturing facility from scratch. And what I mean by that, and, you know, part of the reason why I think that the reshoring in the US is way more complex than people may realize, because in principle, a lot of these things are quite easy to manufacture. Like I could walk you through and explain to you the air filter manufacturing process, and you would look at it and say, oh, that doesn't seem so hard. There's really only 4 components that go into everything. You have machines, you go through the process, train people to those machines, and you're good to go, right? I mean, how hard can it be? The reality is there's so much minutiae that oftentimes is never written down or no one person knows. It's just like, you know, when you have a lot of employees that have been doing a certain process over a long period of time, they learn all the tricks and the things that allow it to happen. So like whether that be examples of things that we, you know, had problems with, like the amount of water to keep in the glue tanks that you're using that feed all of your processes. And as the humidity changes, as the year changes, maybe that changes a little bit. And if you don't know exactly how to keep that consistency right, it can just clog up your whole manufacturing process. And you don't understand why, because everything looks like it's going right, but like you just have your consistency of your glue just a little bit off, or, you know, just little things like that, that you would never even think of as being important. But when you're like running a factory at any type of scale, all of those components it has to be a well-oiled machine in order for it to work, especially efficiently. And that's not the kind of knowledge that you can read about or get on ChatGPT, even though it didn't exist then. You know, that's just the kind of stuff that is what I call institutional knowledge. And that's what I really underestimated when I started it. And like, if I could go back in time, what I would have done is actually bought a small filter manufacturer and kind of bought that institutional knowledge and used that to scale it. But doing it from scratch without any industry experience is very hubristic in retrospect. And it's not something I'd recommend for most people.
Yeah. I mentioned this, I think, in a podcast last week or two, but have you read the book American Flannel by chance?
I have not.
I'll have to send it to you. It's given your background, especially in the textile industry with your family, the goal that they set out, there's a company that sets out to try to create a flannel shirt completely made in America. And the difficulty with which the number of hoops they have to jump through and how hard it is exactly to the point you just made, where there's so much institutional knowledge that just got sent overseas that there was almost no one left in the whole US that could do it. And there was like 7 or 8 steps. Yeah, it shocked me how much went into making a single shirt, which you experienced with on the filter side.
Yeah, and no, like in the air filter business, luckily we don't have this problem because, you know, most of the supply chain is in North America already because of the logistics reasons. But when I look at so many other businesses, the problem is that it's one thing, even if you have the knowledge of manufacturing it or assembling it, the components and the supply chains for all of the components have oftentimes been completely put overseas. So like you're not going to be able to find the raw materials that you need within the US to be able to do the manufacturing because, you know, we strategically as a country, you know, decided to get out of that whole business. And it's not the kind of thing, you can't put that toothpaste back in the tube very easily. You know, and it's not the kind of thing you can do overnight. That's what makes it so tricky, which is why I'm incredibly sympathetic to people and brands that are like, what do you expect us to do? We can't make this stuff in the US. And I agree with them. I mean, I think that's very true. I think that we take that to the extreme in certain cases. I think that it's like there are certain products where that's true, and then there are others where we really should be manufacturing on our own. And this is a little bit of a pet peeve of mine because I think people like to universally say, oh, I can never do this, or universally say that, you know, you got to reshore everything. But I do think that there are a lot of products that you can make competitively where we've gotten lazy and outsourced. And I can't tell you the exact industries because I'm looking at it, but I've looked at a couple of companies in the last few months where that can manufacture in the US. They're like small niche manufacturers. And if you look at the kind of supply chain of those product lines, there you have wholesalers that are importing oftentimes from Asia somewhere and then reselling it to local stores or whatnot. The manufacturer can sell it cheaper than the wholesaler can buy it, but not enough cheaper to compete with the, you know, overseas supplier. And so really the answer in those situations is actually collapsing the supply chain, in my opinion, where you have the manufacturer that's ultimately selling direct to that's actually also acting as a wholesaler, which is effectively the core of our business model. And what like I'm devoting my life and my business to doing is like any area where it does make sense to manufacture and collapse that wholesale business model, you know, I think that we should be doing that. And I do think that if we were honest with ourselves, there are a lot of product lines where that does make sense. But there are also a lot of product lines like the flannel that you talked about and textiles and whatnot, where it's honestly just not realistic given our supply chain. So like I think you have to look at it on an industry by industry and a product by product basis rather than lumping everything into one big soup, if that makes sense.
I really like that take because everyone has been sharing their thoughts on this, you know, the last month or two, but you have a background of US manufacturing, growing up in US manufacturing, seeing the communities that have been affected, knowing the potential labor base or lack thereof, and also understanding capital and financial markets. I know you mentioned you couldn't, you know, don't necessarily want to out the markets you're excited about, but if you had to look at the percentage of goods, of physical goods, we as Americans, or at least North Americans, consume, what percent do you think we could move back? You know, let's say we make 10% in America, just for sake of argument. What percent do you think we could move back and manufacture viably in America versus what percent you think are just a lost cause that, given the supply chains, given labor costs, et cetera, just is not going to come back?
I'd be lying to you if I gave you a percentage, but I will give you a couple of examples just so people go around and think about it. And like what I like to do is really like reverse engineer the whole supply chain and cost structure of whatever product I'm looking at, right? Like I want to know, you know, where can you buy it overseas? What would their cost be to manufacture it if you can figure it out? Like, is there a local supply chain? When it gets to the US, like how many people is it paying or touching? Because every time it touches another person, you're paying, somebody's getting paid in that, right? And so like I like to think through all of that and then say, hey, is there a business model here for me? What we're doing now, which I can talk about, is we're doing this in the cabin air filter market for cars and the air purifier filter market. We haven't actually launched publicly yet, but we've talked about it, but we have all the machinery that we've been spinning up, and we're getting ready to, you know, launch a whole line of replacement cabin air filters for cars. And if you look at the supply chain there, it blows my mind. Basically, every one of our competitors is made in China. I was working on this project for 2 years, and unfortunately, and another reason I'm sympathetic to this taking time, I ordered the first piece of machinery to do this 2 years ago. And it takes time. It was an Italian-built machine, custom-built to be able to do it. But even 2 years ago, it financially made sense to me because I look at it, once you buy this machine, which is, you know, $500,000 machine or something that order of magnitude, not super, super crazy, it's largely an automated process. Like the labor factor in that is almost nothing. I mean, it's a rounding error compared to the in selling price that you'll be selling it to a consumer. So you cannot make the argument that, you know, you need to send that overseas for cheaper labor because it's the labor is not really a factor in that product line. The same is true for air purifier filters. They're all made in Asia. And, you know, we've kind of reverse engineered, figured out what kind of machinery it takes, found media suppliers in the US, which do exist. And, you know, we're starting that process of actually making it. So these are just products that, you know, I happen to understand in the industry I understand. And, you know, I just kind of went down the, you know, rabbit hole of what would it take to manufacture this product. And then you find an equipment manufacturer, you talk to them, they tell you who the suppliers are, you know, and you just kind of keep peeling back that onion until you figure out like, hey, is this something that, you know, makes sense or not? The problem where I do have a problem with the whole kind of debate is that, you know, people say it takes 2 years or whatever, that's too long. That is lazy thinking to me. And that is not a healthy way for us as an economy to be thinking about these problems. And, you know, I know it's hard to say, well, like who's responsible actually for kind of forcing that? The tariffs are almost certainly not the best way to actually encourage that. So like, I'm not defending that, but I do think that is flawed thinking that, you know, like if I can quickly look at the cabin air filter market for cars and the air purifier filter market and say, you know what, you know, we can definitely competitively make this here. Why isn't anybody else doing it? And, you know, I think that there are a lot of products where that would be the case if we were honest with ourselves. A percentage, I couldn't tell you.
Hey, it's Andrew here with a quick sidebar. I want to introduce you to Ori from industrialstores.com. I met Ori at a Shopify event, oh man, maybe 6-7 years ago. It was a period where I got the insane and the very poor decision of visiting like 10 cities in 10 days to host meetups. And Toronto was near the end of the event. Anyway, met him there, become friends since, and he's one of the kindest and nicest and just best people I know. And here's what he has to say about his experience with eCommerce Fuel, our private embedded community for 7- and 8-figure founders.
Hey, it's Ori here. I'm an ECF member. I've been a member since 2017. And when I think how ECF has impacted my business, my life, I think about a lot of things, but you know, I get to think about an amazing network of entrepreneurs that are vetted, that are willing to share experiences, that have helped me avoid many tests through their lessons. And I think about honesty, I think about community, I think about friendship, I think about relationships, and I think about growth. And I've grown as a person. My businesses have grown through ECF membership, and ultimately, I'm so happy. I'll never look back. It's been a great part of my last 5 years or 6 years in my business journey.
After hearing literally hundreds of comments like this over the last decade our community's been around, it's easy to offer our 10x guarantee. If you don't get at least a 10x ROI on your membership in the first year, in terms of increased revenue, saved time, and saved money, we'll give you a full refund plus an extra $1,000. But many of our members report seeing massive value in just the first month or two when applying it to their 7- or 8-figure business. You can learn more about the community and apply for membership at ecommercefuel.com. Okay, back to the show.
Looking, doing a little research for this, came across a couple of shots of your factories, and you've got an assembly line where there's raw products coming off, you know, taking air filters. So you've got the screen, you've got kind of the cardboard that builds around it, you've got the mesh, and those are coming down one at a time. There's a couple workers putting those together. How much, when you think about your factories, I think one of the common talking points are narratives is that we can bring manufacturing back. It's going to be mostly driven by robotics. People don't want factory jobs, et cetera, et cetera. How much of that do you think is true? How much of your factories and supply and the actual manufacturing is automated versus, you know, people kind of just traditional manufacturing line?
We've been investing heavily in automation in the last number of years. And, you know, I think that that is important for a lot of reasons. I do take a little bit of an issue with saying people don't want these jobs. Like I really think that when you hear that, it's oftentimes people that live in coastal cities that, you know, are sitting behind a desk and cannot imagine working in a manufacturing facility. And, you know, I can tell you, we have 1,000 employees, you know, of all different types and all different pay scales, and all of them are very driven by doing something physical and creating something. And, you know, I think it's a little bit insulting actually to have the narrative, and I'm not blaming you. I'm saying it's just the kind of generally how people talk about it is like the people that are saying that are the people that don't want those jobs. And like, maybe they're afraid that they're going to be forced into something, which is not true, but it's like, I just think that's an unhealthy narrative in general. So I would take issue with the narrative, but I do think that the style of these jobs is changing. Like, it's already changed in the 12 years I'm in it. And, you know, you still need people to oversee these processes and to be the QAs and this kind of stuff. So what's ultimately happened is the jobs are getting, are paying better and better. And the kind of work is becoming less onerous over time because of automation and because of machinery and whatnot. So, you know, I think that the reality is very different than the, you know, manufacturing jobs of the 50s. And like, that's certainly not what people want or what I think we as a society want to go back to. But I think that, you know, working in a factory or working in a process, building something physical, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. And I think that there are a lot of people, I know there are a lot of people that are very happy to do with it. I mean, and I did a video about this because it kind of rubs me the wrong way, but like, you know, Ray Dalio was actually talking about it, I think smartly, you know, saying that, you know, one of the core problems we as in the U.S. have is that 60% of our population cannot read above the sixth grade reading level. 60%. And that's just a fact. And so, you know, you have these kind of elitist type people saying, oh, people don't want factory jobs or people like we want to work with computers and whatnot. But on the other hand, over half the population doesn't have a sixth grade reading level. I think that this is the thing that a lot of people that are knowledge workers just don't understand, not having lived in these places, right? And worked with these people that really just want to have a good job and something that they feel proud about to go to every day. And that's one of the things I'm most proud about, you know, that we've built within our culture. You know, we have a lot of people that have been there for a long time that are very proud of, you know, building a quality product that people use day in and day out. And so, you know, saying that we don't want those jobs, I think is not fair to those people.
I'd love to hear just a little bit more about the logistics side of things. In a different interview I was watching, somebody mentioned that you had, I don't know if this is true or not, but they mentioned that you just keep 2 weeks of inventory now and kind of have a very just-in-time approach. Given that logistics is effectively, you know, one of the reasons, maybe in you know, being able to look back, but realizing that that's one of the competitive advantages that allows you to compete globally with this product line, can you run through just maybe at high level, the different manufacturing and distribution plants you have, and then maybe perhaps just the whole process from when one leaves, maybe the supplies that come in, your cogs that come in, making them and how they end up making it to the end customer and kind of how long that takes?
Yeah, absolutely. So we now have 3 manufacturing facilities and 4 distribution centers. So we manufacture in Alabama, Pennsylvania, and Utah, which are, you know, obviously strategically located throughout the U.S. And then we kind of spoke them out to distribution centers in California, Texas, Florida, and Illinois. So we are constantly, you know, we make 120,000 filters a day. Basically, we are constantly just replenishing. We have our production runs are designed to replenish inventory across that network. And so on average, we keep 2 weeks of finished goods inventory within those seven distribution centers, but we keep about 3 months of raw material inventory so that we're always have the ability to react quickly and to make something. But, you know, roughly we keep 2 weeks of finished goods inventory. And, you know, we have about 800,000 square feet in aggregate, and we're full with that, you know, 2 weeks of inventory. Like, you imagine if you needed to keep, you know, 3 months of inventory or whatnot, just how much you'd have to expand and how much square footage you would need. It would be very expensive. And so that's kind of what allows it to work. But then, you know, we're optimized where we can get to about 80% of the country next day delivery on ground and the whole country in 2 days delivery. And I think we're going to start publicly talking about it, but we just recently partnered with UPS and Roadie. Roadie is a company that they bought, which basically, you know, has, you know, contractors like Uber type drivers do the in delivery to a customer. And we're actually splitting out packages and sending direct to Roadie distribution centers, basically in every major city every single day, which is allowing us to, in some cases, do same day delivery, because if we get it to that center by noon, we're able to actually offer same day delivery in Dallas and Miami and a couple of other places. And, you know, the rest of it, we're getting there next day with a pretty white glove, you know, kind of delivery. And that's a, you know, something we're only able to do because of our scale. But the thing that allows for us also is that, like, no, it's a huge competitive advantage for us, because if you're a smaller manufacturer of air filters, like, you're not going to be able, your economics are just not going to be such that you're able to compete from a price perspective on that. And, you know, like, when I look at an Amazon or a Walmart, they always get mad when I say this, but it's like, I know for a fact that someone is losing money on a large portion of the catalog that they are selling. You can argue who it is and why or how they're actually counting in their logistics cost and this kind of stuff. So there's a lot of nebulousness in that. But, like, when you actually just think about the cost of actually moving, like, a large dimensional weight light product through their DCs, it's very expensive. And, like, one of the things I always suggest people to do is, like, look at the FBA fees for, in Amazon's case, and, like, put in your product and, like, how much FBA fee are they going to charge? And what is the inbounding fee that they're going to charge for it? And, like, a lot of our catalog, we would be losing money if we used FBA, because, like, we literally would be losing money even if our product cost was zero. That's how extreme it is. But that's why optimizing this logistics network is ultimately what's given us the competitive advantage to build the business we have today.
Yeah. How do you think about Amazon? I mean, I feel like I've purchased some of your filters on Amazon before. Obviously, massive, you know, half customers, if not more, are there. But you've got one of the advantages that most people don't in the distribution network that lets you compete with them on shipping times. How has Amazon played a role in building the business where it is today? And then how do you think about it going forward? Because I feel like I am very biased in this regard. I've kind of been anti-Amazon from a seller's perspective for years. And I feel like more and more people I'm talking to are just saying, I'm done. Like, fees are going up. It's just all the headaches and pain and other things. So I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on kind of how you're thinking about Amazon right now.
Well, we could probably have a whole, we could do it about 6 hours on this subject.
My day's free. You know, let's do it.
Amazon has been a huge factor in growing our business. And I think that the reality is that if you want to be in the CPG, consumer packaged goods space, in 2025, you have no choice but to have an Amazon strategy. Like, you're completely naive to think that you're going to be able to survive in, you know, a CPG consumable space if you're not going to have a good Amazon strategy. Because for a lot of people, that's where their shopping starts. And, you know, I love to tell this story. It drives me crazy. Like, but you just admitted you bought on Amazon about a year ago. We were about to leave our vacation and my wife was like, oh, I need some air filters. And my wife purchased our air filters on Amazon. Really irritated me. But it's because she was buying other stuff and she's like, oh, I need air filters. So she goes and she just buys air filters. And so, you know, what I like to say is, like, if I can't convince my wife to go to our website or go to Walmart to buy our product or wherever it is, how do you expect me to convince consumer to do that, right? So I've trained myself to be agnostic as to where a customer buys. I just want them, when they buy an air filter, to buy a filter by filter. And, you know, I cannot change the behavior or the behavior patterns of customers. So me trying to put mental energy to fight that, I think is just not smart. So that is my, you know, that's my real answer on it. But, you know, Amazon, the other thing I'll say is, you know, you look at the big brands like our competitor 3M, for instance, or you look at, you know, Kleenex or, you know, any other big brand, you think that they say, oh, we're not going to sell on Amazon because it's getting hard or whatever. It's like, no, it's like, that's a sales channel. You're going to have that strategy. So, you know, I do think that you can't ignore it. I do think that Amazon over the next 10 years is going to be less important than it was in the previous 10 years. Like, I do think that is shifting, and, like, you know, we've not been successful with it, but, like, you look at TikTok shops and live social selling, I think that there's been a lot of shifting happening behind the scenes that I think is likely to continue to really go. And so, you know, I think that you have to always be experimenting and finding other channels that you want to go wherever the consumer is. And so wherever the consumer is where you need to be selling. And so if they're on Amazon, which a lot still are, then you have no choice, in my opinion, but to have a solid Amazon strategy. And at least in a CPG space. We have been fortunate in that, you know, we did do some FBA for a long time, even with our pleated air filters, because we really felt like we had to be competitive and to be in subscribe and save, which is a huge thing for us. You know, we're a top 50 Amazon seller and have been for a long time. And so, you know, I've gotten to build a lot of relationships within Amazon. It's a very fragmented company. So, like, it's, you know, you're always kind of having to build and move around. But in general, I found them to be fair to deal with. You just have to kind of know the rules of engagement to an extent. And you know, we are one of the largest SFP or seller fulfilled prime sellers, and which means that we do all of our own prime fulfillment, which is incredibly difficult and still keeps me up at night a lot of times just because of the pain around it. But that has allowed us to not use FBA, which keeps our fee, which has kept our fee structure basically, you know, static. Like, we haven't gotten hit by the fulfillment fees. But on the other end, we've been investing hugely in our own infrastructure, but it's just like, rather than investing in the FBA infrastructure, we've been using that money to invest in our own infrastructure. So that's been the tactic that we've taken, and I'm thankful for that. I think it's been a huge savings for us. But, like, I think a lot of the pain points that most of people you'll talk to have with Amazon are related to the FBA fees, FBA inbounding, and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, I can understand it's difficult, but we largely have, you know, circumvented that by going direct.
How do you think about growth going forward? I mean, you've got one of the amazing things with your business model is you've built up this customer base over time. It's a consumable purchase. I would imagine a significant portion of your revenue is just coming from people on subscribe, have been using your filters for years and years. For new customer acquisition, maybe outside of Amazon, how are you thinking about that? I think a lot of people are trying to wrestle with that now with Meta getting harder. It's just been a gradual uphill climb for years and years and years, but in particular with margin compression for a lot of people with tariff and otherwise, it's more front of mind. How are you thinking about new customer acquisition these days?
Well, I've answered a little bit backwards in that I think we all have to realize that e-commerce is a sales channel. It's not a business model. And e-commerce is much more mature than it was when you and I first met 12 years ago. And so, you know, the reality is that it is going to continue to get harder. And, you know, it's a lot more crowded than it's ever been. And, like, a lot of the big opportunities have been staked out. Like, you would have a very difficult time starting an air filter business now competing with us, whereas you could have done it 12 years ago. So, like, really you have to be thinking about, like, where are the opportunities next rather than trying to think about what worked in the past. And so, like, I do think, like, I see a lot of people successful with TikTok shops, for instance, and creating content around that. It's very tricky. Like, I'm not good at it. It's not how I've built my business. But I think, like, if I were starting today, you know, I would find something that was more in a more nascent stage like that and focus in on that if I was going to start from scratch. So that's what I would be thinking about for a new person. When I look at our business, our biggest levers are retail, which, you know, last September we launched in 505 Walmarts, and we're starting to expand that. We have a whole team focusing on retail and expanding retail for us. We actually don't view retail necessarily as a big revenue or money driving strategy, but as a brand building strategy, which ultimately leads to brand recognition and people choosing to buy our product. So it's like a long-term, you know, customer acquisition play and brand building play in that case. But the area that within our core business that is I'm most excited about and is by far our fastest growing is our direct business to business sales. You know, so we have a team of 32 outside salespeople throughout the US that are just calling on, you know, hotels, hospitals, gyms, industrial complexes, whatnot, selling direct to businesses. And, you know, that, you know, we published it all, but like this year we're targeting $280 million of revenue or give or take. And, you know, about 25 of that will be our B2B sales. And like 3 years forward, I expect that to be nine figures plus. Like that's the area where I see our biggest kind of growth potential. Whereas the rest, I expect to grow at a more steady, lower kind of growth pace, just because it's a more mature market and we're, you know, kind of tapping up against the bounds of the maturity of that market, if that makes sense.
Most people listening to this or have a business of some sort. Many have seven to eight figure e-commerce businesses, if not larger. And that building out the kind of the COO role in particular is probably a really hard spot for a lot of people and for our larger members and entire executive team as well. Where did you fail the first time doing that? And then what allowed you to be more successful the second time? If you can think through maybe just one or two of those lessons that can help other people potentially, because that's just a hard thing to do. It's something that I think most people do not get right on the first time. So what did you learn the first time around that helped you the second time?
First is that you should not hire aspirationally. You should hire people that have done what you're looking to do before, at least in some shape or form. Maybe it's not the exact same thing, but they've demonstrated that they have the ability to do whatever it is that you're looking to do. It's like if you're hiring a CFO, you don't hire a, you know, kind of person, a young finance person that has a lot of energy, but not a lot of experience, but you think they have a lot of potential and are going to work hard. You know, that is a way lower probability of success and in all likelihood going to create a lot more work trying to train them than going out and really finding an experienced person that has done something similar to what you're looking to accomplish. Because you want to find people that have skill sets that you don't have that are complementary to that. And I think early on, I made the mistake of hiring aspirationally. And I think that would be kind of lesson number one for me. And that's been painful. Another is, you know, people talk about it a lot, but it's sometimes easier said than done, is real culture fit. You know, you have to be self-aware about like what kind of business you want to run and like what your goals and expectations are. And you got to make sure that you find people that are aligned with it. Because I self-corrected from the first thing of like, hey, I want people with more experience. But then if you go out and you find somebody that's super corporate, which I've done, and put them into a real entrepreneurial, fast-paced environment, then they're going to hate it and it creates lots of friction. And I made that mistake when I overcorrected because I realized that, you know, I want to move fast and do things that like somebody with just a ton of corporate experience is not going to be suited for, right? And so it really comes down to that self-awareness of making sure somebody has the experience to do what you need to do, but also is aligned with like who you are as an entrepreneur and where you expect your business to go. And so those are the kind of the two big things you've got to get. But then I've also found, at least in my experience, that, you know, when you're the entrepreneur, your job is to be the architect of your business and the architect of the systems of your business. And so you need my most success has been when I've gone in and I've at least built out the framework for something before I hire somebody to come in and really hone that framework into and to run with it. You don't want to just come in and say, hey, we have this problem. I want you to go solve it and expect them to get it to be aligned with how you want your business to function. You have to take the responsibility to dig in and at least build the framework to be able to hand off to them to make them be successful. And like, that's the other mistake that like sometimes that I have made in the past where I kind of have an idea of how it should work, but I didn't take the time to really, you know, put in the pieces to allow them to flourish when you put somebody as a steward for it. You just kind of hire them and say, hey, you know, you have experience, go do this for me. And then that oftentimes leads to bad outcomes. So those are kind of the three things that I've had to tweak in order to get it right. But like once I have the right framework, I have the right cultural fit, and I have somebody that has the skills and expertise that are complementary to what we need, then that's really where I found the most success. And that's what I'm screening for now when I'm thinking about leadership.
Love it. Can you talk a little bit about filterbyventures.com? That was something that I was not aware of coming into this, but I think it's an interesting part of your future growth and something you should be excited about. So talk a bit about that if you would.
Yeah, so Filterby Ventures is my holding company that owns Filterby and a couple of other smaller entities. And, you know, in the last couple of years, I kind of had a little bit of a crisis of self. You say like, okay, well, what do I want to do with the rest of my life? Do I want to, you know, sell the business and move on and live happily ever after or what? And for me, you know, I really want to continue to build and to have a big impact. And that was a big motivation for me starting to go public with my content, which, you know, I'm David Filterby everywhere. And on YouTube, we started filming a lot of my life and what we're doing. But really, the kind of long-term game for me is I want to start purchasing and, you know, partnering with other businesses in the spaces that I understand, which is really manufacturing and logistics. Like those are the two areas that we have deep expertise. And so, you know, we're constantly looking at other businesses that kind of fit our mold that we can bring in and hopefully grow and kind of build legacy businesses out of. And that's something I'm really excited about and kind of what I'm pivoting my team to allow me to do, to be able to spend more time with other entrepreneurs that maybe have gotten to a certain level of scale, but kind of don't know what to do next, don't want to sell to private equity because they don't really trust private equity, but they're looking for either an exit or looking for a way to have a real kind of growth, sustainable growth path forward. And I want to be a partner for that. And that's what Filterby Ventures is designed to do.
Very cool. Filterbyventures.com. You can follow everything David's doing at David Filterby over on LinkedIn, on X, and of course on YouTube. David, congrats on building something pretty amazing. It's fascinating and pretty impressive to see, especially, you know, yeah, it's 12 years ago. You're kind of in the early phases then, and to see that have grown and evolved over the years, it's pretty cool. So congrats. Thank you for being a part of that very early ECF Live with that talk, and for being willing to come back on and talk about it 12 years later. And we'll keep buying your stuff when I can for our furnaces and filters. And yeah, it's always super good to reconnect on all this. And I appreciate just the story of getting into, you've done something I think not many people have, which is built up a fully integrated U.S. manufacturing company. And hearing that story, warts and all, kind of at this moment in business for at least for the US it's really helpful. So thanks for willing to come on and talk about it. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks for having me, Andrew.
Forging what matters. You likely have heard the name Brett Favre before, but if you're not a big football fan, you might not be fully aware of the story behind his career, especially kind of the later years of his football life. He was once the undisputed king of Green Bay, the longtime quarterback for the Packers. Really impressive career, 297 consecutive starts, 70,000 yards, a Super Bowl champion. And in 2008, after a great career, he retires after 16 years with the Packers, a hero everywhere in the state, in this dramatic, tearful press conference. A few months later, though, he changes his mind, but the Packers at that point had committed to a new quarterback, Aaron Rodgers. So he gets traded to the Jets, plays a mediocre season, and retires until he decides, I'm going to come back for a third time, unretires, and joins the Vikings, the arch rivals of the Packers, shocking and alienating his entire fan base in Green Bay that he had built up such a sterling reputation with over 16 years. They have one reasonably decent year and a final just awful year where they go 5-8. He threw more interceptions than touchdowns and had some personal scandals as well. Three total retirement on retirement cycles and ends with his legacy tarnished. And why? He had such a good thing he could have ended with. Well, it's almost certainly because of identity. His sole identity was as an athlete, and he didn't know when to let go and move on to different things. And then there's Johann Sebastian Bach, and you also have heard this name before, as the famous composer, was once considered Europe's greatest organist, renowned performer. But later on in his life, his son became more famous than he was in terms of contemporary circles. And the public viewed his music as increasingly old-fashioned and antiquated and not really that valuable. And his fame and recognition declined dramatically in later years. And it wasn't really until, I don't know, years and years after his death that most of his work became just the absolute staple of classical music that it is today. And that's why we know, of course, when we say Bach today, we know Bach, we're talking about Bach Sr., not Bach Jr. But the fascinating thing is that Bach Sr., as his fame and recognition declined and he was eclipsed by his son, instead of getting upset, he turned inward rather than chasing more and more fame. And he focused on teaching and mentoring younger musicians, probably also including his son, didn't seem concerned with his declining popularity and aged graciously, aged with class and with meaning. And the cherry on the top, of course, is that, even after all that, he still became incredibly famous after his death. One of the books that I have read that I've thought the most about the last year is a book by Arthur Brooks. It's called From Strength to Strength. And the main point of the book, he says, is everyone faces inevitable decline in fluid intelligence, which is kind of the first part of your career when you have innovation and speed and energy and raw processing power. That's something that almost certainly is at your peak in the early part of your life and fades over time. And we all reach that point where we can't perform like we used to. And we have one of two possible responses to this, at least based on Brooks. We can desperately try to extend our first curve like Favre did, and it is going to end badly. 100% of the time, it's going to end badly. Or we can choose to embrace our second curve using what he calls crystallized intelligence. Crystallized intelligence is actually some of the things that we get sharper at and have as greater assets as we age: wisdom, judgment, being able to synthesize information, experience, things like that. And Brooks says, the key to life is not hanging on to our fluid intelligence as long as possible, that first stage where you're doing as much as possible, you're getting the recognition, but rather making the jump to the second curve of crystallized intelligence before the first curve peters out. And I think about this a lot. I, 42 years old, been at this for 17 years, I'd like to think I have a few more great years ahead of me, but I also know I don't want to pull a Jordan or a Favre and be hosting an econ podcast at 72 from the retirement home, right? I want to know when it's time to move on or shift. And I already even feel that, I feel a bit of that. When I started, Econ Fuel Podcast was one of the only ones out there and felt like I had a lot to contribute, especially on the tactical side. And now there are lots of other amazing podcasts, many with hosts much more experienced than I am and larger listenerships. And there's two ways I can react. I can feel threatened and mad and try to push harder towards that, or I can be really appreciative for the ride I've had, for this amazing community I get to try to foster, to share what I know, to lean into some of the aspects of maybe the non-business side where I feel like I have something unique to say. And this is not a retirement speech. Again, 42, hopefully I have a few more years. Not giving in. I plan to keep working hard and to hopefully to keep doing what I'm doing now for years to come. But I don't want to cling to that with desperation when the time comes to shift course. And I especially want to make sure that my identity isn't so wrapped up in the measures of success that I try to keep my current trajectory going at all costs. I do not want to be the 48-year-old guy at the college party trying to blend in. So just something to think about, something I've been thinking a lot about, and I'll leave it with this. Quote from Arthur Brooks from his book, "Success addicts withdraw and live in memory. Happier people keep jumping to new curves of meaning and purpose." And I'll add at the end there, when the time is right. If you're an entrepreneur who wants to connect with other experienced owners who are working to build a financially vibrant business alongside a rich, meaningful life, head on over to ecommercefuel.com to learn more and connect with 1,000 entrepreneurs just like you. Work hard, adventure often, and forge what matters. Look forward to seeing you again next Friday.